And now we're going to turn our attention to an important new documentary, an expose of an invisible environmental disaster lurking just off the coast of Southern California with repercussions way beyond that. Out of Plain Sight documents the legacy of nearly 500,000 barrels of waste containing the carcinogenic pesticide DDT, which was dumped off of the California coast decades ago, with environmental and health consequences continuing today. Rosanna Shaw is an award-winning environmental reporter for the Los Angeles Times, and along with Daniel Straub, she is the co-director of the award-winning documentary Out of Plain Sight, which is a cinematic expansion of one of her most haunting environmental exposés. I know we've had her on this program to cover that topic when it first came out. Now, the film has won numerous film festival honors, including the Audience Award at the Santa Barbara International Film Festival and the Berkshire International Film Festival. And for those of you listening from the San Francisco Bay Area, there will be a special screening of Out of Plain Sight tomorrow, Saturday, November 1st, from 1 to 3 p.m. at the Roxy Theater in San Francisco. The event is presented by the Redford Center, which will also moderate a post-screening Q&A. So, Rosanna, welcome to the program, and congratulations on the documentary.
Hi, Ethan. Thank you. It's so good to be here.
And Rosanna, I have a lot to ask you about with the documentary, but first, as we were just talking with Matt about Hurricane Melissa, I know you have covered sea level rise. You have a book on sea level rise and California, which I've talked to you about when it came out. Now, what is your sort of take on what's happening in the Caribbean with Jamaica's population? So many of that population lives in low-lying coastal areas. What's your take on the impact of these storms and sea level rise and what that means for those residents?
Yeah, I mean, I've been following the news all week, and it's just, I mean, to what Matt was saying too, I mean, the data is so important, having information so that we can make as informed decisions as possible. You know, how do we turn uncertainty into risk calculations that could actually help inform communities on what to do, and just the intensity of making these split second decisions. My heart really goes out to what's happening right now. And I think, you know, we do go through these cycles of sunny days and not thinking about the urgency of these issues, and then being hit with just the immensity of these disasters. And I think the more we're able to prepare in the ebbs and flows of these increasingly extreme disasters and extreme weather, I think the more we will be able to be prepared in a more thoughtful manner in the future that will ultimately support as many communities as possible.
Well, Rosanna, I also have to ask you about the coverage. Same question I had for Matt. What would you suggest to the media in terms of linking climate change with these types of stories like what we're seeing with Hurricane Melissa?
Yeah, I mean, definitely everything that Matt has already said, but I think also just really understanding the nuances and the social aspects of it. And, you know, it's multifactorial, right? And I think that there's a lot of accountability that should be looked into and any of these cases, and also kind of our social responses. You know, for example, like once you send out an alert, how do people respond to that? And I think in addition to kind of the causes, really thinking about how as a social system, as an ecosystem, we are responding and not responding to these increasing threats. So I think, you know, it's really important to really acknowledge the foundational causes of just our increasing number of extreme events and extreme weather and extreme disasters, but also thinking about how our responses and our lack of responses and lack of preparation are also part of what makes a natural disaster more than just natural.
Yes, it becomes more of a human-caused disaster when we can't respond properly and can't diffuse the causes, the underlying causes that make these disasters worse. So let's talk about your documentary now. I hope our listeners in San Francisco can make time to see it tomorrow. I want to quote from Andy Howell, who's a staff scientist at Las Cumbres Observatory and a professor at UC Santa Barbara, who said in a review of your documentary that, quote, the film dramatically illustrates both the importance and process of science and journalism at a time when both are under attack. And I think that really captures the film in so many ways. And so for people who have not followed your work, it's based on your award-winning investigation into how the waters off of Catalina Island in Southern California became a dumping ground for the now banned pesticide DDT. Can you talk about how you first came to learn about this environmental crisis in the first place?
Yeah, so a few years ago, I wrote about how a research team at UC Santa Barbara, led by Professor David Valentine, had come across these eerie looking barrels on the seafloor just off the coast between LA and Catalina. And he had access to all this like amazing deep sea technology from the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution that allowed us to see the seafloor in ways we had not been able to before. And Professor Valentine was studying something completely different on the seafloor and came across these barrels. And when he first showed me those images, I was like, oh my God, like, what are these barrels? What's in them? How many are out there? And that led to just this massive unraveling of a history that we had just collectively forgotten about. It turned out that the largest manufacturer of DDT in the country, before the chemical was banned in 1972, the largest manufacturer of this pesticide was actually based in Los Angeles. And in the peak of its production in the 1940s and 50s, this company had, quietly dumped their acid waste into the ocean right off the coast of LA. And, just kind of going back through this history has really opened up this broader conversation about how we used to dump all our unwanted chemical and industrial waste into the ocean. We literally treated the ocean like the world's biggest landfill. It was out of sight, out of mind, and we have collectively forgotten about this and moved on. But the chemicals are still out there, they're circulating in the environment. And now that we know the questions that we had stopped asking and we're starting to ask them again, there has just been follow-up after follow-up after follow-up. So I've been following the story for the past 4 years.
And Rosanna, how many sites contain these toxic barrels? Can you give us a visual of where they were dumped in the ocean?
So, I mean, without giving too much of the film away, and I will say, like, this film focuses on one quote unquote dump site, which is both a useful term, but also not useful when you think about how vast and interconnected the ocean is, right? So I will say, we focus on the dumping history of one chemical off of one coastline, off of one quote unquote spot in the ocean. But this is a prox this serves as a proxy to all the other chemicals and all the other places along every coastline in this world where we did once, dump all our unwanted industrial waste into the ocean. And so this is a story that is paralleled, along any coastline if you choose to look, and along rivers and other watersheds. And I think, again, this film is hopefully prompting a broader conversation on our relationship to the environment and what we think we can just because we dump something, can't see it, and forget about it and move on, does not mean that the consequences of that pollution goes away.
And Senator, why did you decide to turn your investigation for the printed version of the LA Times into this documentary film?
Yeah, so when I first broke that first story a few years ago, I mean, it activated, like, it mobilized an incredible, community of marine scientists. It, kind of Congress with Senator Dianne Feinstein at the time really led the charge on asking kind of the next step questions and thinking about what we needed to do in order to just wrap our minds around this massive issue. And I also at the same time got, flooded with queries from filmmakers wanting to turn my reporting into a film. And I'll be honest, I was really hesitant at first. This is a messy and nuanced story and a really hard science story to get right. And I am at my heart a very old school newspaper reporter. But I was really intrigued by the potential for, film as a storytelling medium, especially with kind of the visual of the barrel, and also thinking about how leveraging or using kind of the visual form of film, and also the sonic textures of the film, and turning kind of an invisible issue into a more visible issue that you can experience more emotionally as well. And so, this feature-length documentary has turned out to be a pretty unprecedented film project for the LA Times. And I would say huge credit to Daniel Straub, who is such a great director. He and his brother Austin Straub, an amazing cinematographer, indie filmmakers, amazing documentary filmmakers. They basically showed up to a talk that I was giving a few years ago, and they convinced me to let them tag along the next time I was out in the field with the scientists. And we didn't know at the time if we were going to end up with a short film, a feature-length film, or anything at all. But just on like day one of being in the field with Daniel and Austin, I was just completely blown away by how talented they were at seeing the story from a visual perspective that I had not quite picked up on, and also how thoughtfully they honored the journalism process and the science process. And it was such a collaborative process making this film as well. I remember on that first day, we weren't sure if I was going to be a producer or, you know, quote unquote, on-screen talent. And Daniel, I just remember within the first few hours of filming, turned to me and he said, "Rosanna, my first decision as the director of this film is to make you also the director. Like, let's find this film and this story together." And so, you know, what this film ended up being, as we continue to follow the subsequential like stories that came out of that first article that I published, you know, this film ended up truly being an extension of my journalism. It's not a film about my journalism or an adaptation of my journalism. It is my journalism. And you, the audience, are on this journey with me as we figure out, you know, the many layers to this haunting story together.
Well, we have a lot more to talk about with Rosanna Shaw, award-winning environmental reporter for the LA Times, about her new award-winning documentary, Out of Plain Sight, on the dumping of toxics off the Southern California coast. This is Ethan Elkind. You're listening to Your Calls Friday Media Roundtable, and we'll be back with more after this. Welcome back. For those of you joining us just now, I'm Ethan Elkind, and this is Your Calls Friday Media Roundtable. We are podcasting our show. You can find out more information at kalw.org. Click on news and you'll see Your Call listed there. You can also listen to our past shows there if you've missed shows in the past that you want to hear. And if you have a show idea for us, we love to get listener ideas for shows. You can drop us a line at yourcall@kalw.org or call us anytime at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. For the rest of the hour, we're going to continue our conversation with Rosanna Shaw, award-winning environmental reporter for the Los Angeles Times, who, along with Daniel Straub, co-directed the award-winning documentary Out of Plain Sight, which is really an expansion of one of her most haunting environmental exposés on the dumping of DDT off of the Southern California coast. And a reminder for our listeners in the Bay Area, there's a special screening of the documentary tomorrow, Saturday, November 1st, from 1 to 3 p.m. at the Roxy Theater in San Francisco. And the phone lines are open. We'd love to hear from you. If you have questions about the story of DDT dumping off of Southern California, if you have concerns about the impacts of DDT, stories to share about how you learned about this toxin and its effects, the number to call to join the conversation is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255, or send us an email to yourcall@kalw.org. So, Rosanna, I want to get a little bit into the history of this dumping. When was it first known about all of this toxic dumping in the waters off of Los Angeles?
Yeah, I mean, when I first started making phone calls after Professor Valentine called me and after seeing the images of the barrels on the seafloor, like right off the coast of LA, you know, people, you know, when I was tracking down people from back in the day, like, "Do you remember anything?" They would tell me, like, you know, "Yes, we had heard rumors of this dumping, but no one could prove it that far underwater. But now that we have the technology to actually see what's on the bottom of the ocean, like, oh my goodness." And, you know, this film in many ways is about the questions that we didn't know we still needed to be asking. And, you know, I mentioned this earlier, but, you know, as one scientist really put it to me, like, just because we collectively forget about an environmental problem does not mean the problem just goes away. It eventually comes back to haunt us. So this chemical has been sitting out in the ocean for decades. It's been circulating through the environment, and we're now just waking up to the fact that this is still an ongoing pollution problem that has spanned, at this point, multiple generations.
Well, let's talk about DDT, and you have some wonderful footage in the document, really disturbing footage now that we know its toxicity, of kids being sprayed with DDT. And can you just talk about, you know, what makes this type of chemical so toxic? What makes it what we call a forever chemical? How long is it going to be staying in the environment if we're not able to do anything about it?
Yeah, so to step back for a moment, I mean, DDT was this pesticide that was super, super popular in the 1950s. You know, in the documentary, you'll just see footage of us just spraying this chemical over crops, in grocery stores, over, you know, livestock, and it was highly effective at killing bugs and fighting malaria, but it was also so powerful that it poisoned birds and fish, you know, and it also just takes a really, really, really long time to break down. DDT is the original forever chemical before we even had come up with the term forever chemical. And the thing with DDT is that we're still learning the long, long, long-term effects of having this forever chemical still circulating in our environment and accumulating up our food chain. And, you know, the impacts of chemicals like DDT truly can span generations as it's turning out. And there is still so much that we don't know about the long-term health and environmental impacts. And I would say it's also worth noting that DDT is what sparked the modern environmental movement with Rachel Carson's Silent Spring in 1962. And you know, that book is like the Rosetta Stone for our understanding of just the need for environmental protection and basic concepts like ecosystems and the food web and how everything is connected. You know, this chemical was actually what sparked all of those conversations that we now so often take for granted.
When you have some wonderful footage of Rachel Carson in the documentary, and of course of Rachel Carson had the quote, "But man is a part of nature, and his war against nature is inevitably a war against himself." And I know you have that quote in the documentary too. Can you describe how DDT affects marine life in particular? There's some heartbreaking footage of some of the California sea lions who are getting cancer and treated and die at a marine mammal facility that you visited and filmed. So what kinds of effects does DDT have on the marine ecosystem?
Yeah, I mean, the saying at the time was that dilution is the solution to pollution, and we're learning that, you know, many generations later, that is absolutely not the case. You know, I think some folks might be familiar with DDT's impacts on eggshell thinning and how it devastated bald eagles and ospreys and other bird populations. But, you know, DDT is still showing up today in really mysterious ways in California sea lions, dolphins, and even the California condor. And all these animals are super high up on the marine food chain, which means that this chemical is still clearly accumulating in really concerning concentrations across the entire food web. And so there is still a lot of unknowns. Like, there's a lot of ongoing science right now trying to trace how this chemical might still be moving through the food web. And, you know, from the deepest parts of the ocean all the way to potentially the top of the marine food chain, you know, what are the pathways? And are there any ways to potentially contain it or stop it at some midpoint, you know, up from, you know, the bottom to the top? So those are all these ongoing questions that, you know, a lot of really interesting science is happening. And I'm hoping that in the coming years, we'll have a lot more answers.
We're speaking with Rosanna Shaw, award-winning environmental reporter for the LA Times, about the documentary Out of Plain Sight on the dumping of DDT off of the Southern California coast. The phone lines are open if you have a question for Rosanna about DDT, about toxins in general, or sea level rise for that matter. She's written a whole book on the impact of sea level rise on the California coast. The number to call to join the conversation, 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also send us an email with any questions or comments you have at yourcall@kalw.org. Now, Rosanna, what do we know about the impacts on human health of DDT?
That's also still an ongoing question. I mean, the peak of DDT was, you know, in the 1950s. We know that DDT is a chemical that is hormone disrupting, and it, you know, accumulates in our fat. There's an incredible research group led by Dr. Barbara Cohn in Berkeley with the Public Health Institute, and basically, like, they have been tracking and following a cohort of women, you know, more than 15,000 women since the 1950s. They started with, you know, women who were pregnant at the time of like peak DDT exposure, and then they, you know, sampled their blood and kept track of their health vitals. And then after those women had their daughters, and their daughters had their daughters, and now their daughters are having their daughters, they're able to kind of track the, you know, A, first, the direct consequences of DDT exposure, and now kind of the later, less direct, but still pretty like astounding, continued, long-lasting impacts of how exposure to a chemical even generations ago could affect the, you know, the female that was being developed in the womb and the eggs that they were developing at the time they were in the womb. And I think just it's really interesting to think about how There are just so many unanswered questions about how exposure to a chemical that is so unseen and so, out of mind, and this idea that we banned a chemical in 1972 and, we're done, we took care of it. That's just not the case. And I think, the work that's being done at places like the Public Health Institute in Berkeley is just incredibly important. And just to have such a long-term data set spanning so many generations is going to be the key to understanding a lot of these issues. But they've so far found connections to increased chances of getting breast cancer, obesity, early menarche, testicular cancer. Like there's it's been really interesting to see how they've been just kind of tracing all these different pieces across so many different generations.
And Rosanna, in your investigation, you point to Montrose Chemical Corporation of California, which opened its plant near Torrance back in 1947. And at the time, the chemical industry was celebrated for preventing crop failures across the globe. The U.S. used as much as 80 million pounds of DDT in 1 year. So tell us about this company and how do they end up dumping all this waste in the ocean without anyone knowing?
I mean, I will just say this was standard practice at the time to dump, this was the 40s and the 50s, to dump the industrial waste and the chemicals that we didn't want to put into a landfill because it felt too close to home. And we took it out into the ocean and just treated the ocean like this receptacle for all of our unwanted chemicals, thinking that we do have such a, we still, we have a, such a land-centric way about thinking about our relationship to the planet, to the environment. And this was just standard practice. Once we knew what questions to ask, I found shipping logs documenting pretty meticulously all of the different chemicals from all these different companies that just, hired a company to barge out to see all of their unwanted waste. Every week, this is how many barrels got dumped. And, once Austin Straub, who was our cinematographer, but also our editor and archival researcher, he was able to find so much footage in the public domain that just really showed how standard practice this was. And I think that's kind of one of the really humbling things about just this thought exercise of going back through history and realizing how quickly we can collectively forget what has been done in the past. And as the ocean and coastal environmental reporter for the Los Angeles Times, I am often thinking and writing about stories about our future. How do we adapt to sea level rise? How do we think about the ocean as a solution to climate change? And how can we think about the future and how can we think about our relationship to the ocean as it pertains to quote unquote solutions of the future when we haven't fully learned the lessons from the past and what we have actually already done to the ocean? And I think those are really important questions to ask ourselves. And yeah, again, like this was just standard practice.
One of the things I really appreciated about the documentary is that it's not just about the deadly legacy of these chemicals, DDT. It's also about scientists and organizations like the Pacific Marine Mammal Center in Laguna Beach, who are working to really heal the coastline from this type of pollution and the ecosystems there. And you also have some extensive interviews with the deputy director of the EPA's regional office for the Western States in San Francisco. And as we think about the Trump administration cutting back on investments in science, on regulatory enforcement at agencies like the EPA, how are you thinking that those types of, policy approaches, rollbacks, cutbacks, lack of enforcement, how will that be affecting issues like this with the DDT dumping off the coast and what that could mean for ecosystem and human health?
I mean, so many thoughts here. And I will just, the film does, take you through like 80 plus years of history, fast forward to today. And, one part of that history is we do gently remind folks that the EPA was created by President Nixon. The, Marine Mammal Protection Act and the U.S. Marine Mammal Commission was created under Nixon. And, no one wants to get cancer and no one wants to swim in polluted water. And this doesn't have to be a politicized issue. And I think it wasn't for a really long time. And I would also add that I think at a time when, there is so much distrust in science and misunderstanding of science, the filmmaking team and I felt an immense duty to actually document the scientific process, like not only just, show you the finished peer-reviewed paper and here are the findings and here are the results and blah, 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 but actually like let us show you the people behind the data gathering, who are literally working hours and hours and hours at sea every single day, collecting, you know, methodically all of these samples to help us understand this one piece of truth and all of the work that goes into that and the rigor that goes into that. And also with journalism, I think I was really nervous for a while about having a film team document my journalism as well. Usually we just put out the article once it's all tied up and ready to go. And I think I've been reflecting about this a lot in the past few years, but I think we do owe it to the public to rebuild that trust with the reader, with our audiences. And I think the more we can rebuild that trust, the more people can appreciate and understand why it's important to support science like this, and that it doesn't have to be politicized. And I think the other thing I mentioned, the Public Health Institute and their multi-generational, you know, cohort of women that they've been studying since the 1950s, one of the lessons that I took away from just the process of making this film and talking to so many research groups is just the power and importance of long-term data sets. You know, once my first article got published and it activated all of these scientific questions, people were able to go back to, like, you know, the Cal Coffee archives at UC San Diego, you know, and managed by NOAA Southwest Fisheries, you know, being like, oh my goodness, we've been collecting, you know, fish samples across this very, very, very organized system across the entire Southern California Bight since the 1940s. And we can go back through time now to track and see whether or not, you know, DDT peaked at a certain point in fish populations and whether it's been declining or how that has changed over time. And they can go back through time and actually study that. But what happens if we lose those archives? What happens if we lose the institutional knowledge? That's kind of what's at stake right now. And that is those are some of the less obvious things that we're about to lose as a society if we do continue down the path that we're going down right now.
Yeah, the kind of work and information that we take for granted that underpins so much of our understanding of what's happening and the threats that we face when it comes to environmental issues in particular. I want to read an email question from Ted Brinkley, who writes in, can your guest verify that the makers of DDT simply took their product overseas after it was banned in the USA? So Rosanna, do you have any information about what happened with DDT after we banned it?
Yeah, thank you, Ted, for that question. So DDT was banned in the US in 1972 in terms of use, but we were still allowed to make it. And so Montrose did continue to operate its facilities in Los Angeles until 1982. Next decade basically shipped their DDT abroad. And, you know, DDT is still being used in some countries today because we have not necessarily found a quote unquote better solution to curbing issues like malaria and West Nile. And so this is, and it's interesting for me, like over the years, going also back through the news archives, seeing how this question of public health has been pitted against environmental protection and, you know, environmental pollution. And so, but to answer your question, Ted, like Montrose did operate for a number of years after 1972, because there was still a market and a demand for DDT at the time abroad.
So we're speaking with Rosanna Shaw, award-winning environmental reporter for the LA Times, who co-directed, along with Daniel Straub, the documentary Out of Plain Sight, which really expands on her reporting on the dumping of DDT off of the Southern California coast and the impacts that that has now on our ecosystems and on human health as well. The phone lines are open if you have a question for Rosanna about DDT or toxics in general or media coverage of these issues. The number to call to join the conversation is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255, or email us with your questions or comments to yourcall@kalw.org. We have another email in from Philip, who writes, many of your listeners are probably artists or hobbyists that use acrylic paint. Acrylics are microplastics, and the wastewater that the painting process generates should never be poured down the drain, but they often are all too often. There are methods of handling the waste that avoids polluting the waterways, and I recommend anyone involved to investigate YouTube videos that will help to handle acrylics responsibly. Philip, I appreciate you writing in with that information. Rosanna, curious then, you know, any thoughts you have about acrylics or just toxics in general when it comes to the ocean? Are there things that we should all be aware of, resources that we can consult for how to better manage the pollution that goes into the ocean?
Yeah, I love that point from Philip. And I think, you know, it's interesting, like this film is about a chemical from our past And, but as you watch the film, like a question that clearly emerges is, just what are the DDTs of today that we are still putting into our environment that haven't been banned yet, that haven't been deemed quote unquote bad enough, that 50, 60, 70 years from now, we'll be looking back and thinking, what the heck were we thinking? And I think there are a lot of parallels to that. Microplastics came up a lot in conversations, in my conversation with scientists. PFAS, acrylics is interesting, but just, I mean, just actually just sparking a consciousness for people of all of the chemicals that are in use. And not all chemicals are bad, but I think that we do walk through this world pretty unmindfully for the most part. And I think just the more we're able to just take a moment to actually think through what it is that we are putting in our environment, I think it will lead to a lot more thoughtful and measured conversations. And we might not be able to fully rectify the consequences of our history with DDT specifically, but there is so much we can do with so many other pollutants today to not repeat these same mistakes.
And Rosanna, is it possible to clean up DDT? What are the options for removing it from the environment?
I mean, those are still questions that are being actively looked into by a really robust scientific community that has been supported by, state and federal funding from the past few years. And I mean, one of the really painful lessons here is that once you put a chemical, a forever chemical, into the environment, it is so hard to take back. And we are currently dealing with just not even knowing the scope of how much got put out there. Like, how do we figure out how to clean something up when we don't even know how much got dumped? So that's, one of the main questions, number one. And then also kind of questions on like, how does a chemical move through the environment? We don't know that much about how a chemical like DDT actually moves through saltwater and the ocean and through the marine ecosystem. And there's a lot of really important science being done right now to just really build this foundational knowledge that we didn't realize we needed. And to what Matt Simon was saying earlier on today's show, like data is just so important in order to help us actually make informed decisions and also questions about how we actually move forward from a problem.
Rustin, I know you've been traveling across the country with this film. What has the reaction been from the public, from those who have had a chance to watch the film?
Yeah, it has been so incredible getting to share this film with audiences across the country. We're actually just in Indianapolis last week at the Heartland International Film Festival. And just to see people really connect with the story everywhere has been really moving. And, I will say, as a print journalist, I don't ever get to watch people read my articles, but to be able to sit in a theater with like 300 people and really experience other people experiencing the journalism, that has been so powerful. And just I've also just really loved seeing how much people have connected with the filmmaking aspects of the film, which has also kind of been something I've been thinking a lot about as a print journalist in terms of thinking about the power of film in today's world. And, the cinematography from Austin Straub is beautiful. And a lot of people have also commented on our score and the sound design in this film. We were lucky enough to have teamed up with an incredible composer, James Ellington, super early in the process. So he basically helped us find the sound for the film before we had even started cutting together scenes. And he had been following my reporting for years and just really understood both the spirit of the story that we were weaving together about the ocean, also the spirit of the journalism. And he was asking us questions like at the very beginning, like, what should science sound like? And we were like, huh. And so, and we also got to work with like a really great sound team, Gigantic Studios, and who really also got to the heart of the story. They give voice to like all of the soundscapes that like define California at sea, in the science lab, soaring over Big Sur. And you're going to just feel so immersed watching this film in a theater, thanks to Gigantic Studios. And they really designed it for you to experience it. And I'm so excited to be bringing this film finally to San Francisco. It's going to be the first time we're playing in the Bay Area. I love the Roxy Theater, and it's so meaningful having the Redford Center presenting the screening. The Redford Center is truly just the gold standard for the importance and power of telling environmental stories through film. And I think that is truly a mission that we have also just really wanted to honor with just like turning a print journalistic, piece of reporting into something that is cinematic and filmic.
Yeah, again, for listeners in the Bay Area, that's 1 to 3 p.m. tomorrow, Saturday, November 1st, with a post-screening Q&A as well. Well, Rosanna, we're almost out of time, but what's next for you? Just briefly, would you do another film? Do you have other stories you want to preview here?
I mean, the stories about our ocean and our relationship to the ocean are endless. And with this film, like we're still not quite at the finish line. We actually have we have a big screening at the National Academy of Sciences in December, which will be super cool. We're about to play a 7-day special theatrical run in Los Angeles from November 19th to 25th. So through the end of the year, I will be taking this film to as many audiences as possible, and I'm just really grateful for all of the conversations that we have been sparking about our relationship to the ocean and, with chemicals and pollution and all these invisible aspects of our environment that we should also be caring about.
Well, the documentary again is called Out of Plain Sight. Rosanna Shaw, reporter for the LA Times and co-director of the film, thank you so much for coming on to Your Calls Media Roundtable talking about this issue, and congratulations again on the film.
Thank you so much.
And for more information, including details about that screening or to watch the documentary trailer, you can visit our page at kalw.org, click on News and Your Call. That's our show for today. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit us at kalw.org. You can also find us on iTunes, where you can give us a review, and you can follow us on social media and email any show ideas and feedback to yourcall@kalw.org. Malihe Razazan produced today's show. Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Ethan Elkind, and it's Your Call.